Grace, the Amy Santiago of Royal Bloggers.
And I'm Jessica, the Dorothy Sporanath of Royal Bloggers.
And we'd like to welcome you to On Air, the podcast where two cynical Brits discuss the latest royal news and the truth behind the stories. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the On Air podcast. Hope you enjoyed listening to last week's episode. It has been a week where things have happened and we looked really, really hard at doing some non-British and Swedish stories. But the most topical events were British, which is not our fault, honestly.
No, it's not.
We are trying. But we are heading back to Britain. One day we'll get away from them. With two different stories. But we are going to start with the surprise visit that the Prince of Wales made to Poland during the week, and talk a bit about the trip and the role of William and the monarchy in kind of diplomatic / controversially military-esque issues.
Right, I need to remember that so I can put that exact phrasing in the description of the episode, because that was super clear and helpful.
That'll summarize it. They'll look at that and go, oh, I know what this is about.
Right.
Because, yes, obviously, he travelled to Poland to kind of support the troops in the Russian/Ukraine war. So that's why he went there. And also, he's a royal. So there was a link to this logic. But yeah, we thought we'd start with a bit of like where he went, what he did, and then our thoughts.
Yes. So I don't really know what order these things happened, but I know what the things he did. I think on the first day he visited a military base, which was about 60 miles from the Ukrainian border, and he spoke to Polish and British troops who are involved in supporting Ukraine in the war against Russia after the Russian invasion. And then on day two, he went to an accommodation centre to meet some Ukrainian refugee families. He laid a wreath at the tomb of the unknown soldier, and he met with the Polish Prime Minister. Is that a good description? Is that a good summary?
Yeah, I think that summarises it.
There wasn't anything else I've missed, was there?
No, that's all I had.
But yeah, the visit was a secret beforehand. So it was just like, surprise, William's in Poland, which I think is understandable, given the fact that he was initially on the first day in particular so close to the Ukrainian border. I think it kind of reflects the risk involved in his visit. And I was quite surprised. You know, I know that it was a secret, but I was also surprised. Sometimes they announce a secret and it's like, well, obviously that was going to happen. But this, I was genuinely surprised that he was in Poland all of a sudden.
Yeah, there was no kind of like pre-warning.
No.
Like a couple of Polish/Ukrainian visits in the lead up, which is like, guess what? William's in Poland.
Yeah. So it was, I think I was definitely surprised to see him there. I think he's kind of become like the go-to guy if you want a tour that is potentially a little bit risky, but also gets a lot of press attention. Like other royals will do ones that are risky, but they don't get a lot of press attention. But I think like the Israel and Palestine tour, and then this one, like if you want somewhere that's going to get a lot of press attention, but also is potentially controversial, William's your guy, apparently.
Yeah, he seems to do them quite well, like far better than he does the normal soft diplomacy tours.
Yeah.
They're a bit controversial. These he's great at. Just keep sending him into high pressure situations and he'll be fine.
Yeah, he'll be absolutely fine. So I mean, it was a risky thing to do, and that's why it was very surprising for me. I never thought any royal would get that close to Ukraine, to be honest.
Yeah, I was like, oh, in my head, because I think we've seen so many royals doing like Ukrainian things, like meeting with Ukrainian refugees, mm-hmm. or training in quotation marks with the military. I was like, oh, that's nice. Lots of them do this. And I looked, I was like, oh no, they don't. This is like William's thing. Like, they don't just go and hang out at the Ukrainian border very often.
No, they really don't. Yeah. So it was quite a surprising thing to do. I think it was also risky because of the potential like political implications of the visit. So people often say that royals can't be political, which is nonsense, because the king signs our laws and they are inherently political. They can't be, this is my My motto, anyone who follows me on Tumblr knows it's my motto, royals can be political, but they can't be partisan. And so far, every UK political party that's in government backs Ukraine and backs our support for the people of Ukraine and backs like military intervention on an official level. So it's not a part, you know, I think there would be a temptation for some people to be like, why is he going to this thing? This is really political, blah, blah, blah. But it isn't partisan. And that's the most important thing.
Kind of think like, I don't know, when we in our LGBTQ plus episodes we did, and we spoke about how like in the UK, like every major political party is pro like gay rights. And it was like our Tory party, who are like our conservatives, the more right-wing party of major ones. We have far more right-wing ones, but anyway, point is they were the ones who like introduced like gay marriage. So for William to appear on the front cover of, you know, magazines and do lots of work in this area, there's no controversy around it because all the politicians are like, yeah, good for you. And it's kind of like it's similar because obviously in Britain all the political parties I think are like, yes, team Ukraine, so we support Ukraine in this. It's not like there's like a little outlier going like, not us, we have our own opinions.
And there's a difference, I think, people get confused about this quite a lot, but there is a difference between kind of and what an individual politician thinks and what is in your party manifesto or what is your official party line. So it's, I think there are definitely going to be Labour politicians who are probably pro-Russia, maybe anti-intervention, and have their own opinions about it. But that's their opinion. It's not the opinion officially of the Labour Party. And so it isn't partisan. You can't possibly do something that's going to be supported by every single person in the world, but it's the official party line, and no official party is a contradictory to what we've been doing in Ukraine so far. So it's not partisan for him to go. And also it's quite clear that the government wanted him to. So it said explicitly that this visit was made on behalf of the UK government. So it wasn't just William being like, you know what, I'd really like to go to Poland and hang around for a bit and meet some Ukrainian people. It was something that was done on request of the government, so is therefore part of his role. And even if it had been partisan, that would then have been the fault of the government. So like a few weeks ago, there was a bit of conversation about whether King Charles did something partisan by meeting with Ursula von Leyen, is that her name? Yes, around the Brexit deal. Not going to get into that because it's a whole thing. It would take me 25 minutes to just explain the background of it. But there was conversation about whether or not that was partisan. And it might have been. But if it was, the fault lies with the government. And Charles was just doing, he was just following orders. He was just doing what he was told. And that's his job. And so if this had been a partisan visit, it would have been the government's fault. But it wasn't, because it was supported by every sort of major political party. So, you know, he was going because that was part of his job. And that happens a lot with royals, where they sort of, they've had to meet with people who I might not necessarily like. You know, they have met with Putin, or they met with Donald Trump, or they've met with other dictators and things. But if they're doing it on an official level, or like Saudi Arabia or whoever, if they're doing it on an official level as part of their job, then the fault is not with the royals. The fault is with our government for deciding that they want the royals to meet that person, or that they want to ally themselves with Saudi Arabia. It's not the fault of the royals. They're just doing what their job is. It's different if they're like hanging out with them privately. But if it's an official duty, you know, I think people get confused about where responsibility lies sometimes.
Yeah, I always think about that like first Donald Trump visit to the UK. And people were like, oh, I'm so proud of, you know, like, I think Harry and Meghan weren't involved in it. And they were like, well, I'm so proud of them for standing up for them not going. And, you know, it's a real disappointment that William isn't standing up for Kate. And it's like, they're just doing their job. Like, yeah. Chances are, when they did it, because it was like a scaled back thing, the Queen was like, look, I want minimal people, but the ones who have to be there. So Harry and Meghan, you get out of this one, you're fine, but you two've got to come.
Yeah. Hadn't Meghan just had a baby as well? Not long.
Yeah, she'd literally just had Archie, I think. It was like literally like May 2019.
So it was
one of those things where people were either complaining that, you know, as they do, Harry and Meghan don't do their jobs, or that William and Kate were suck ups to Donald Trump. It was like, no, they're literally just doing what they've been told to do. Like when you're at work and someone says, can you go and work with that person, you don't like them, you don't go, no, you just kind of get on with it.
Yeah. I mean, I do, but that's a whole different matter.
It's a whole different thing.
Yeah, that's my issue. But yeah, no, I think it's a weird thing because I don't understand why people find it so difficult to understand it. And I don't know if that's just because we are British and so we understand this system kind of more implicitly than maybe somebody from the US who has never grown up in a monarchy. I don't know if it's because I work in the charity sector and we have similar limitations on, you know, we're allowed to lobby and things like that, but we're not allowed to, I don't know, post a statement saying the Tory party is terrible. We're not allowed to do that by law. So we have similar restrictions around being partisan. So I don't know if it's that, but I always find it funny when people find it so confusing about what royals are and aren't allowed to do. But yeah, I think it might have seemed like a risky situation politically for people, but you know, it's part of his job. It's something that he was requested to do, and there's no major political party that disagrees with it. So I don't see a problem with it. But I mean, it did open him up to criticism potentially, and I've seen like some Russian. I mean, I didn't read much about it, but I did see some headlines saying that, like, he's been the target of Russian mocking, and you know, because obviously he's a high-profile visitor, and Russia likes to undermine everything that we do. So they were just, you know, making fun of him, and I think that's actually why it was probably a good idea, from my perspective, to balance this kind of military visit on the first day with the humanitarian side of things and meeting with refugees on the second day, and meeting with the Prime Minister as well, because I think those people who might have thought that the military angle was a bit inflammatory potentially, like, I mean, you can't really disagree with it being important to support refugees, you know. So it's more like, I think that was smart to balance it and not just have it be him going out to visit the military for the day.
Yeah, and I think the fact, obviously, it was a Poland visit and he went to visit the Polish and British military. Mm-hmm. First of all, I didn't even twig there were British military in Poland at the time. Yeah. I did not know this. This is how I've learned. But, like, the fact that his visit was at a British army base, yeah, kind of, I don't say, like, reduce the level of criticism, but people could be like, well, he's the future head of the British military, rather than being like, why is this random British man just rocked up to talk to the Ukrainian forces, you know?
Yeah.
It is kind of limits the inflammatoriness of it.
Yes, that's definitely a word.
So inflammation doesn't sound right.
And I think, you know, it actually will kind of relate to some of the things I talk about under the Kate section later on, under our section later on, where I think people might be like, well, why is he going to visit Polish troops who are fighting in Ukraine? That's got nothing to do with us. But the angle of meeting with British troops who were there as well kind of made it a bit more British. And also, it's the UK government at the moment, I mean, the Tory party had a very bad 2022. And I think that they know that a potentially good PR move would be going, oh, remember all the stuff we've done for the people of Ukraine? Aren't we lovely? Aren't we humanitarians? Aren't we great? So it probably is quite a good PR move from them as well to be like, oh, look at, you know, we'll send William and then everyone will remember that actually we did all these great things in 2022. So yeah, I think it was a visit that, like, I'll get onto my feelings on it later, but I understand the purpose of it and I don't think that it was actually an issue politically or anything like that.
Yeah, I also think that it was, like you say, it wasn't just like politically non-partisan, but it was also like publicly as well, because as like most people in Britain, you know, no matter their opinions, are pro-Ukraine, and even if they're not, they're pro, like, looking after poor children who have to flee Ukrainian war zone. I think it's one of those things where it wasn't like a risk in terms of publicity because there isn't like a massive vocal group of people who were like, no, leave the Ukrainian refugees to die. Whereas, you know, for some other wars, that probably is the case.
Yeah. And I also think it's not an entirely new thing either. I'm sure you'll have much better notes about this than I do. But I did actually put some effort in. So Grace and I were talking about this beforehand, and I was like, I'm probably not going to do any research. Try to avoid that as much as humanly possible. But I did some research.
I love it. I'm excited to hear it.
Now I've been put on the spot. So I tried to look at a few other times that royals have visited somewhere that is connected to a war. I was typing in, I was like, well, it's not a war zone. He visited Poland, which is not a war zone. So like, but I've tried to find some similar situations. And the one that I think is probably, or possibly most famous, is in 1999. Have you got this one?
I do have this one.
Yeah. With Princess Anne and King Charles both visited Kosovo, where they met with troops. And I sort of had this vague recollection in the back of my head about Charles's visit. I didn't know that Anne went, and she actually went first. So props to Anne for always being forgotten. Charles's visit got a huge splash, whereas Anne was there like a month after the conflict ended. But anyway, I think that situation was slightly different because when I was reading about it, Charles met with 10,000 or some of the 10,000 British troops who were part of a NATO-led peacekeeping force that was 3 months after the war in the Balkans ended. So technically, it wasn't like an active war zone. The situation had already finished, whereas obviously in Ukraine, it hasn't. So it was a slightly different thing. But I mean, Anne visited like a month after the peace agreement was signed. And it still was somewhere where we had troops who were overseas helping, in quote unquote, countries overseas. So, you know, I thought that was an interesting example.
Yeah, and I thought, you know, the first one I thought of was a bit historical, was in World War II, when the King and Queen of the UK stayed in Buckingham Palace. It's not the same thing in the way that they travelled to visit a war zone that was going on. But, you know, as we've heard from some of the royal families, they left the countries, they went to America, or, you know, at least they got the children out and something like that, just to kind of protect them. But, you know, the first thing I thought of was during the war, obviously, the Queen Mum and King George and Elizabeth and Margaret stayed in London to kind of like bolster that kind of spirit of being like, oh, if we can be here, you can be here.
Yeah.
And, you know, doing this together kind of positive vibes, which is kind of, you know, when you send a royal or a high profile figure to someone like this, it's kind of like, I'm with you. Like, we're all on the same level. I might be a major celebrity in my own right and have lots of money and perfect safety. Mm-hmm. But at this moment, we're all equal. I've done a lot of World War II at school. And when you say it to the kids, it shocks them because they're like, but they were the king and queen. Like, they helped, they're rich and famous. They have to go to safety. Mm-hmm. So I always think like that's one of those things that does win you a lot of favor, but also really sort of is memorable for the people who experienced it with you.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting to kind of, if you compare it to the 1999 visit to Kosovo, I was looking into that and it came at a time when morale was really low in the armed forces. Apparently there was a higher percentage of staff members in the military who were in active service than any time since the Second World War. So they were stretched really, really thin. They had, you know, most people were in active service, which is not very common. And that was because of like Kosovo and Northern Ireland and a few other things that were going on. And so sending Charles was a bit of a PR push. You know, he's the person who they all swear allegiance to, and he was going to meet them directly, and kind of it was felt that that could boost morale. And it is a similar thing to what happened during the war, of like they wanted to be there to support the people who were fighting in their name, essentially. And it was a huge PR push. And from looking at the stuff at the time of 1999, it also was very well received by the military. You know, I think as somebody who's not part of the military, I might be like, why? That's not going to help me if they send Charles over. It's like when your workplace gives you like pizza or ice cream for the day or something. It's like, yeah, but you still are terrible. Just because you gave me pizza, it might have been okay for today, but every other day is awful. I felt like it was kind of like that. But actually reading it, the troops seemed to really appreciate it, that he went over to somewhere that was just 3 months earlier and at the war zone. And I think it's a similar thing with what happened in the war. You know, it was obviously a time when people were struggling, and lots of people were drafted into being part of the war effort. Lots of people died. There were times where there was really low morale, and having the king and queen there did definitely kind of boost people's spirits, I suppose. And so I think a lot of the time it is used as a kind of, it's a PR exercise, but I don't mean that in like a cynical, horrible way of like they only did it because of the PR angle. I just mean that like it does sort of boost their image, and it boosts the morale of the people who were actually doing the work, that they were kind of recognized by people who could have very easily stayed within the walls of their palace. But we're jumping all over the map here. I normally like to do things chronologically, but I never even thought of doing the war effort visit.
We're just
jumping around in time. I think I also had in 2008, Prince William went to Afghanistan. Which was a bit
secret
more
visit.
A secret visit. It was much more like this current visit to Poland, because stuff was actually going on at the time in Afghanistan. It wasn't like a peacekeeping mission as such. And yeah, it was very similar to this one in that it was kept secret. I think we didn't actually find out until after he'd left, potentially. So he did the whole visit without us knowing. I think that was also very well received by army personnel at the time when I was reading about it. So I think, you know, it's quite clear that regardless of what I think about it, the people who he's actually meeting really do appreciate these visits. And I'm sure that it was the same with the Polish and British troops in Ukraine. Given the historical record, I can't imagine that they felt any differently from how people felt in Afghanistan or in Kosovo or anywhere else. So again, we'll get onto my sort of general thoughts in a minute, but I think whenever it's a visit, I have my own thoughts, but I think that the thoughts of the people who they actually were visiting are always more important. And so regardless of what I feel, clearly this would have had the Afghanistan visit and things, it has the intended effect, which is to make people feel better about the thing that they're doing, which is a really difficult thing to do, which is be part of the military, you know?
Yeah, and I think it's quite notable that, well, not notable, but it's quite interesting that the only kind of two big including sort of cases of royals almost sort of like entering active war zones or being kind of there is William, because every other case I could find were people who were going to sort of neighbouring countries, but specifically to visit refugees. So in 2013, I think, Charles and Camilla were visiting Jordan, and they met with Syrian refugees. Or Sophie visited Lebanon quite recently, I think, and again met with Syrian refugees because they're all sort of neighbouring countries to Syria. So they kind of, royals tend to do the humanitarian side of it. Like they go, they visit, they look at the I wasn't on positive PR because they're refugees and they're in a horrible thing, but they are the ones that are going to get you the nice front page picture. And, you know, no one's going to fight you too much about going to visit some orphan children or, you know, people who've been maimed in horrible incidents. So they tend to do that. But it is really, I kind of, in my head, I thought it was a really common thing, but it is really sort of few and far between where they go to or near to an active war zone.
Yeah.
Or even kind of in the immediate aftermath of a war to meet with people. So it's quite, wasn't it? Props to William, but props to William.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems when I was looking, so like Charles went out to Afghanistan in 2010 as well. So it seems to be William, Charles, and then Anne also did Kosovo, but she was meeting troops and like charity representatives and a few other people. So I don't think it was like, I mean, I might be wrong, but I don't think she explicitly went out there and sat and met with the troops only. So it was maybe slightly different, but I think it is kind of reflective, the fact that mostly the people who've gone to war zones and things have been William and Charles. It does kind of reflect what we were talking about last week of the kind of how hard the British royals go for the military. and also the fact that like some of the monarchies, like Sweden, the king is not head of the military. It's not quite the same thing as being met by somebody who you either currently swear allegiance to, or you know in the future you one day will swear allegiance to.
I don't want to make it sound like keep calm and carry on, but it does very much sort of feel like it ties in with that that kind of like real British ideology of being like, you have to sort of just get on with it and, you know, supporting our troops, which, you know, I know it's not only a British thing, but I do think it's very sort of linked heavily back to World War II, that kind of case of we have to, you know, be, you know, back the boys and support them. And, you know, whereas, you know, I think if we were visiting, I don't know why there would be sowers in a war zone, but if we went to visit some sowers in a war zone, it'd probably be like, why are you doing that? But because it's the military, everyone's like, oh, that's all right. That's all right then. You do you. It's the military.
Yeah, it's quite expected amongst the British public that they kind of, they have this close connection. As we talked about last week, that, you know, we just kind of, it's so close that we almost forget how close it is. It's because it's just the norm. So just, yeah, some general thoughts. I think you can listen to the last episode to find out more about my general views on the military. So I think it will come as no surprise that the visits like this are never something that I'm massively comfortable with, or that I'm entirely at ease with. But if I put that aside, I do think this was actually a really smart decision. And so I'm going to go off on a tangent for a second, but it will make sense. I listen to a lot of like rock music and metal music, and a lot of the songs that I listen to, there are themes. So like War Pigs, for example, by Black Sabbath, great song, you should listen to it. But there are themes in a lot of these songs about how it's the rich, powerful people who give the orders, and then the sort of poor, ordinary, powerless people who carry out the orders in war. And William wasn't fighting, obviously. He wasn't going, because, I mean, he wouldn't be allowed even if he wanted to. But he wasn't fighting out in Ukraine on the front lines. But he was still taking a big risk, and to his own safety. And that is reflected by the fact that they weren't allowed to tell you that he was at this visit until it already happened. It was embargoed to kind of protect him, because he was only 60 miles from the border. And I think that him taking that risk gives him some credibility. So like, you know, kind of what we've been talking about throughout, of like, if he's going to be in charge one day, people want to feel like they're serving somebody who kind of understands what they're going through. And so even though he can't necessarily understand, because he's not fighting as such, he's still, you know, the fact that he took that risk, I think, does give him credibility in the eyes of the military. So I think it was smart from that perspective.
Yeah, definitely. I think we kind of said last week, like, it does, it obviously levels the playing field, but it feels a bit like, oh, he's one of us. And, you know, and how even if Roy's military servicemen aren't pro-monarchy, they tend to be pro the monarch in the way that that's who they swear allegiance to. So sort of fostering that relationship, I think, right from, you know, the early stages is key, almost, because you're a monarchy, you want the military behind you.
Yeah, and I think it was smart for it to be now, because I think, I mean, I don't know what it's like in other countries, but I think when the Russian invasion first happened, Ukraine got a huge amount of attention. I remember actually in the podcast, we talked about it for like 3 weeks in a row. We were like, what's the latest on what royals are doing for Ukraine? And we had like a running feature almost, because it was taking up so much attention with the royals, but also with politicians, with the newspapers, with on social media, people were talking about it. And I think like every kind of social issue, over time, people become complacent and they stop paying attention and stuff stops trending on social media. And there was like the first anniversary not that long ago, but it kind of, I felt like it was smart to wait until it had almost fallen out of the public eye and then be like, okay, well, we're going to send William, and that's going to remind everyone that we are still there. We are still fighting. We are still part of this, and it's still happening. Ukraine is still not in a good position because it's still under threat by Russia. So I thought it was, you know, they could have obviously sent him a year ago or 6 months ago, but it actually felt really smart to send him right as people have started to stop paying attention to this. So I thought the timing was really smart as well.
Yeah, and for me, now I know they did not time it to coincide with an accidental French Revolution, but it happened at the same time. It was a real stroke of luck, because while you have, you know, the, as I'm sure you know, the state visit from Charles and Camilla, the King and Queen, to France was cancelled because of the protests happening in France. The French being very French, very traditionally French,
yep,
going all out.
Love a protest, don't they?
And, you know, they've got quite a history between the French and beheading their monarchs.
Yeah. And the French and the British as well. Yeah. Like, not getting on well.
And, you know, I think it is actually completely the right decision for the King and Queen and Buckingham Palace and also Macron and the French Parliament, maybe, to cancel that visit. It's then really elevates what William did by sort of going by himself and, you know, a very hefty security team to the, you know, all but the Ukrainian border. And I think, you know, the visit was embargoed, and I can't tell if it was supposed to initially have been embargoed to the end of the visit or until he left Rzeszów, which is the town so close to the border, but a few pictures leaked while he was still there. So, you know, it added that risk that I'm sure they were not planning for. And it did feel like in the first half an hour, everyone really scrambled to just get on top of it.
Yeah.
But they did a very good job. But I think, you know, him doing that normally looks really good, but him doing it when you've got a visit to France being cancelled for security reasons just looks phenomenal.
It does, doesn't it? It's quite funny. One of my favourite articles about the France visit was saying that the red carpet wouldn't be delivered on time because of the protests.
Like, oh, no!
And I know that that's not why they cancelled it. I know that it was like an optics thing. It would look really, really bad to be having this lavish dinner at the Palace of Versailles while the people outside are struggling and protesting. Like, that would look really terrible for everyone involved. So it was the right decision. But in my head, it's definitely Charles cancelled the visit because he couldn't get a red carpet while William is going out to Poland, very close to the Ukrainian border. And I know that that's not what actually happened, but it's a much funnier version in my head. So it's what I'm going with.
Yeah, it's definitely the version I'll be telling people.
Yeah.
Actually, you've misheard. It's about the carpet.
It's about the carpet. That was just my favourite story. I was like, of all things to be complaining about, the fact that the red carpet won't arrive is apparently a big deal. But yeah, no, it is an interesting thing, isn't it? Like, how a visit that obviously is much more potentially partisan. It's not partisan, but people might think of it that way. Or a visit that's more physically risky went ahead, but they can't go to France. It is very funny.
Yeah, it just, I mean, it's partly because it's the French, and there's nothing against French people, but like, I've seen Les Mis a lot. So in my head, I'm like, yeah. Man the barricade. They're actually doing it. I love that for them.
I also really liked that they balanced it with that refugee element. I think firstly, it sort of offset the kind of discomfort that I feel around anybody being involved in anything that seems like it's promoting or endorsing a war. You know, I don't have any discomfort about William going to Poland to meet with Ukrainian refugees. That's not something that bothers me at all. So it was nice that they had kind of something for everyone. So if you're not a fan of war, you can still like some of the visit. But I also think this is obviously not what was intended because it was the Tory party who sent William. But I quite liked it because refugees have been a very big talking point in the UK recently. And I think there's been a huge sort of crackdown from the Tory government that, you know, they're potentially breaking international human rights laws to try and keep refugees out of the country, and it's awful. But I think a lot of the rhetoric, they make it sound like Britain is the only place in the world that takes in refugees. And so part of me really liked that he went to Poland and met with refugees because it was kind of like, actually, this is a global thing. We actually take comparatively less than a lot of other people. So pipe down already. So I know that wasn't intended because obviously it was the Tories wouldn't want that to be the focus point, and it hasn't been a talking point in the news. But for me personally, I quite like that he went to Poland, he met with refugees, and it kind of reminded people that, like, actually lots of other people have made sacrifices and have taken people in their countries. It's not just us.
Yeah, it just really remind me of the Gary Lineker thing.
Like, oh yeah,
I don't know if it made global news, but Crisp Salesman and Gary Lineker tweeted the most benign comment about how the rhetoric that our Home Secretary was using sounded very 1930s Germany.
Yeah.
Caused a major issue with sporting TV programming for a whole week. And it was the most minor comment. And I remember my mum saying, while it was happening, she was like, I wonder if he tweeted something like, oh, I'm so angry at Putin, or yeah, I really support the Ukraine, you know, the Ukrainians fighting back, would that have been such an issue? Because that would have been going with the government. But it still still is a, you know, it's a partisan comment, it's a political comment. And that was the whole thing. Like, Gary Lineker can't be political because he only knows football. And it really made me think about it, because I was like, actually, no, you're probably right. If he tweeted something like, yeah, go Suella, it would have been fine. Like, they wouldn't have kicked up a fuss.
Actually, it's interesting that you say that, because I know for a fact that that is true. So basically, the BBC is a publicly funded organization. It's government funded. And so part of their mission is that they're supposed to be balanced. They're not supposed to be overtly aligned to one political party. However, our current government interprets that as either they can't say anything at all. They just have to talk about, like, I don't know, fruit flies or whatever, as they do in the one show. Or they can be positive about what the Tories like, but if they talk about anything positive towards Labour, that is partisan. And the great example, which I know you would like because we both watched The Apprentice, is Alan Sugar, who's the presenter of the UK version of The Apprentice, said on Twitter, "I seriously back Boris Johnson to be the new Prime Minister. The public like him and he will have a good chance of winning the general election. Anyone who can stop Jeremy Corbyn from becoming Prime Minister has my backing." Now, that is overtly partisan. And he is the presenter of a major BBC TV show. So, like, yeah, he's posted some offensive partisan things, and the BBC did absolutely nothing about it and actively defended his ability to say what he wanted. Whereas with Gary Lineker, he wasn't allowed on the TV for a week.
Yeah, like, there was no football shows. Everyone was panicking. It was really fun. I was having a great time.
That's bonkers. So yeah,
it was a live stream on the BBC news webpage about who was going to present what football show. It was like the most fun I've had for years, honestly.
Yeah, suddenly football is fun.
It was great.
Yeah. So I think that for me, as a, you know, I mentioned last week, as a bleeding heart liberal, I actually quite liked that part of the visit, because I think that it unintentionally was bad for the Tories in my imagination, because I'm like, well, everybody else is taking in refugees as well. So why are we special and different, you know?
And I think coming off that kind of Gary Lineker debacle, where the government have just been like, oh no refugees never allowed in the UK ever, to being like, yeah, we're sending William to meet some refugees in another country, was not the best move they've ever made in their little Tory career.
I mean, I think there Ukraine is one of the few places where there's actually a corridor and a sort of, there are legal mechanisms for people to be able to leave Ukraine and come to the UK, because it's a socially acceptable refugee. I mean, this is outside of the scope of this podcast, really, but but yeah, I have a lot of thoughts about that. So yeah, but I don't have any more about William.
No, that's all I have on William.
So our second topic of this week, we are moving on to William's wife, the Princess of Wales. We're very narrow. I mean, normally we're like quite British or Swedish heavy. This time we're literally just in one family, the British royal family. But Kate announced a new strand to her early years work, which is a business task force. And the members of the task force are Aviva, Deloitte, IKEA UK and Ireland, Co-op, Lego Group, Iceland, Unilever and NatWest Group. And she brought them all together for an engagement.
Essentially, I was reading the Business Task Force page on the Early Childhood website, and it was like, run by business for business.
Yeah, snappy slogan.
Yeah, I was like, I love it. Go with that. Sounds like The Apprentice. But essentially, it's like, it is the, not necessarily like the next big move, but it's the next sort of step past the Shaping Us campaign. And she did a article for the Financial Times, which kind of elaborates on it a bit more. And it was kind of her saying that they've started to raise awareness for the public, and these are some of the things that now they can start doing sort of alongside it. And it is essentially a case of them trying to work with the private sector, work with the businesses to promote this kind of understanding of the importance of the early years, so they can embed it in their business practice. With the view to having a really happy, healthy workforce in 20 years when they're all grown up, which is, you know, it works. If it happens, it does actually work. So it's all about, you know, having these businesses working about allowing, you know, young parents the freedom to pick children up from school or having creches at work and things like that.
So I think there have been some comments that have been swirling around social media, which we're going to talk about. I'm going to start off with the ones that people have been saying that I think are completely wrong. So what have they been saying? So the first thing that has come out that, I mean, I've had a lot of arguments about it, and I haven't had an argument with anyone for a while. I've been so calm and reasonable and chill for the last few months, and people just really annoyed me about this. But there was some comments about how Kate shouldn't be working with non-British or non-Commonwealth companies. And I think this is particularly being brought up because of a lot of criticisms around Harry and Meghan, because they often did things with like a charity that only works with children in Los Angeles. And people were like, well, you're British royals, why are you doing that? And it's, I mean, it's nonsense. I'm going to, that's the, if you stop the episode here, you just know it's nonsense. So every organization that is on the list of companies that Kate is working with for the Business Task Force is a British company, except Lego. All of them are British companies. So even IKEA UK and Ireland, yes, IKEA was founded in Sweden, but IKEA UK and Ireland is a UK registered company that only operates in the UK and runs all the IKEA branches in the UK. It is a British company, even though the original company was founded in Sweden. It is a British company. Lego Group does have a British company, but it's not the one that was on the panel. So Lego is the only company that is on there that is not a British company. So firstly, let's say that that's just nonsense. The idea that they're even working with loads and loads of non-British companies or non-Commonwealth companies when there's literally one on that entire list. So the only organisation that could potentially be an issue is Lego. And I actually did the research on this, which again is very unlike me, because I'm extremely lazy. But when I was responding to an anonymous message on Tumblr, Lego have over 1,000 employees in the UK. They have a UK registered brand, which I mentioned, but I also think something that's helpful context that maybe people are not as aware of is that Lego have a charitable arm, like most charities, and I think some of the other charities. I think I might have forgotten Iceland. Did I forget Iceland?
You did forget Iceland.
Iceland are also on the panel. I just realised that, but yeah, Iceland are also on the panel. So yeah, I think most of the other organizations will have some sort of charitable branch like Co-op in Iceland and things, and Lego has one, and their charitable branch is entirely dedicated towards the early years. So the other organizations, they'll do lots of different areas, so lots of different sort of areas of giving, whereas Lego is, because of what they do, I suppose, is solely dedicated towards supporting the early years. And they actually have given millions and millions of pounds to the UK's earlier sector. So quite famously, they sponsored the establishment of the Centre for Play, I think it's called, at the Cambridge University, and the Professorship of Play. So it's a guy whose job is basically to research how play is important in the early years. And he has supported Kate's early years initiative himself. So there is that connection there. So yes, Lego was founded in Denmark and their profits go to Denmark, but they are the single biggest corporate donor to the UK's early years sector of any corporate organization in the entire world. So sure, they're a Danish company, but the idea that they have like no connection to the UK whatsoever is just completely absurd. Because yeah, they if you were talking about the UK's early years sector, there is no organization in the world that has more reach there than Lego.
Yeah, and it's one of the things that, yes, the headquarters of, like you said, the company is in Denmark, but I always said that, you know, the people who work for these companies in the UK live in the UK.
Yeah,
like I don't know, if I set up a business in France, and that was like where I lived, and I moved to France and everything, yeah, but then my only shop was in Birmingham. Yeah. Like, yeah. And I was supporting the workers in my shop. Like, it's going to help people in Birmingham, not me, yeah, in France.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting case when people talk about like the nationality of Kate's designers. That's not actually as much of a conversation now as it used to be, but I remember in the early years when I was in the royal fandom that it was always like, Kate's never wearing British, she's wearing H&M and Zara, and they're Swedish and Spanish, and you know, and yes, that's true, but she will have bought that outfit from a Zara shop in the UK probably, so that will have been contributing towards there being Zara shops in the UK. It will have paid the salaries of the staff members who are British who work in the Zaras and the H&Ms. So I understood if it was like a company that predominantly existed in another country and didn't have any shops in the UK or something like that. But I think people are have a very black and white attitude of like, if it was founded somewhere else, it belongs to that country and the UK can have nothing to do with it. And that's not what the situation is. Their companies are global nowadays, guys.
All around the world.
They all around the world. So yeah, it just I think, you know, Lego employing 1,000 people in the UK, it's not as big as like IKEA or Co-op or other places, but there are lots of British companies that she could have worked with that employ 400 people who are in the UK. So because they were founded in British, are they therefore helping more or connecting to more British people than a company that was founded in Denmark that has over 1,000 employees in the UK? So I think kind of on the flip side of that, I then had somebody coming to me and saying, well, why does she have to work with UK companies? Anyway, that Anon was wrong. And I was like, well, actually, no, I disagree with you as well. being a royal is her job. And we as the British public are her employers, and to a lesser extent, the rest of the Commonwealth. They don't pay as much money. So, but she is still part of, you know, their ruling family. And I think it's just common sense that you don't work for another company, especially a potential competitor, which is another country, on your work's dime. Like, if I started working for a different charity and during my 9 to 5 and I spent every day working for this other charity while still getting paid by my current workplace, that would not be okay. You couldn't just go up and turn up at another school and teach there for 6 months without ask and get paid by your school without asking them. Like, that's not something that could happen. That's just common sense. But I think it's a lot, it's kind of nuanced. And if Kate had like 100 patronages in the UK, I would probably, or worked with millions of companies in the UK, I'd probably let one foreign company slip in or one foreign charity or something like that. But I think ultimately people are acting like you have, when we say you have to work with British or Commonwealth companies or charities or whatever, that we're saying you have to work with places that only work in those countries, and that is not true. You can work with a company that or a charity that has a presence in lots of other countries, like, I don't know, Princess Anne and Save the Children, for example. That's an international organization. It is based in the UK, it was founded in the UK, and it supports UK children, so it's absolutely fine. It also works in a lot of other Commonwealth countries, so that's fine. So I think I don't understand why this is so confusing for people, really. I think it's like, you can work place, the UK and the Commonwealth should be your primary focus. If other countries benefit, then that is fantastic. Then that's brilliant. And if you're the UK government asks you to go and visit another country like William's done in Poland, then that's also part of your job. But you don't work in places that are exclusively outside of the UK and the Commonwealth. There's a tendency for people to kind of be like, oh, well, this is hypocritical because people could criticize Harry and Meghan. But like, if you can't see the difference between working with a global company that also has a base in the UK with 1,000 employees and gives millions and millions of pounds to the UK versus a small community group that only works with a group of children in Los Angeles, I don't know how to explain it in any other way.
Yeah, I feel like that kind of like 80s, 90s, noughties celebrity activism, which was very much like save the African children above and beyond anything else, kind of warped people's minds in terms of charity giving. Because there was such, I think for so long there was such a focus on, oh, go abroad and help people in these poor countries that are so much worse off than us. And that's how, even now, I think if you say like, oh, can you name me like a really charitable celebrity, people will think of people like Madonna or, you know, Angelina Jolie, who do a lot of their work, you know, for UNICEF or work in, you know, countries like Rwanda, which is, you know, all fine. But royals aren't celebrities doing work for a charity. They are doing a job which involves charity work as like part of their, part of their career remit. Like, they've got to do this, but their job isn't actually being a charitable ambassador. It's working for the government, it's head of state work.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like, I'm not, I think people, again, deliberately kind of misconstrue this and are like, oh, but if Kate cares about Lego or whatever, or I mean, it's, I don't know why I'm talking about that because it's not an issue that Kate's working with Lego. But if it, or if, you know, Megan is American, so of course she wants to support American charities. And it's like, I'm not expecting her to forget who she is. And I also think if it's in her own time, she can support as many American charities as she wants to, or she could when she was a royal. None of this matters now. But, you know, she could have. But it is a job. And I think I said that a few episodes ago as well. This is becoming my other motto. So be political, but not partisan. And this is a job are my two mottos. Because but it is, you know, like if Kate wants to support a non-British, non-Commonwealth organization in her private time, that's absolutely none of my business. But she is getting paid by us, British public, to do a certain job. And so she, all of the royals have an obligation. And I, you know, I am relaxed about it if, like, it's Princess Anne, who does 400 engagements plus every single year and has dozens and dozens of UK patronages. If she randomly decided that she wanted to have a patronage that only works in Germany, I'd kind of let that slip, you know, because she does so much already. But if you've only got like 25 patronages and you're only doing 150 engagements a year, I think that you can't afford to prioritize a totally different country that is not paying your bills. But Kate's not doing that anyway in this case, so it doesn't, you know, it's fine, you know. But I think that's why it would have been an issue had she been working with a company like, if nobody in the UK had ever heard of Lego and they had no base here and they'd never given us any money, and Kate was like, I really want to work with a toy company from Denmark that no one's ever heard of, then that would be strange and I would find that an issue. So the second major criticism that I have seen is a very light and fluffy topic: capitalism. Woo! So our friend Rosie got a message on Tumblr, which I think has kind of sparked this section, about how Kate was like capitalism Barbie or capitalist Barbie, which is an excellent phrase. I mean, I didn't agree with the Anon at all, but I love that phrase.
But yeah, maybe I am a capitalism Barbie. So what?
And I think that primarily came from the fact that she was, I mean, firstly, that she was working with businesses, but also some of the language that was used in like the various places, like the press release and speech she gave and all these other places, because she very heavily emphasized the idea that supporting children in their early years means that they will be good workers in the future.
Yeah. Which, you know, I understand that as an initial reading, that's what you might think, but then engaging the brain. Surely. It's when you are trying to promote something, you appeal to the people you are promoting to.
Yes.
For example, when I was tutoring my friend in her GCSEs in biology, she really likes animals. So I linked everything to animals. I'm not particularly an animal person, but when I spoke about it, everything we did was through the lens of animals. It's the same thing. She is promoting the early years through the business lens. So everything she said was through a business lens. There's no point saying, oh, it's really good if we, you know, support the early years because we're going to have loads of athletes in the future, because that gives them absolutely no incentive to do it. But if you go, in the future, we are going to have a really efficient workforce because if you do this, and then it's going to be really good for you, you have that incentive because, you know, we're in a capitalist society. Everything is money driven. Of course, the businesses want in 20 years to have a super efficient, healthy workforce. It's just common sense.
You are completely right. And I have a few things. So yeah, firstly, we're all in a capitalist society. And I think a lot of the time you hear people use that as an excuse to not do anything. So like for global warming and things, capitalism is really what's the problem. And me using reusable straws and my, you know, reusable bags or whatever, that's not going to really fix things in the way that the supermarket I'm shopping at could fix things. However, that doesn't mean you don't help or you don't try. And I think a lot of people use the whole we're in a capitalist society, nothing matters thing, so that they can just as an excuse to not help people. Now, saying that, I actually do personally hate the language that she uses around this sort of thing. And it isn't just about the business, because she has mentioned this before, where she very much talks about it's important to help children because of the adults they'll become. And I mean, you're a child for 18 years, and I think you deserve to have a good time and be happy and healthy during those 18 years, not just because of who you might be as an adult. So on a personal level, I don't really like this language. However, you are completely right. And I actually have an unusual expertise in this area because my job is to get funding from often corporate organizations for the charity that I work for. And this is what you have to do when you're talking to a corporate audience. Like Aviva, they're an insurance company. They're one of the places they were on the list. Why would an insurance company care about what's going on for a three-year-old? Three-year-olds don't take out insurance policies. So what you have to do in order to convince them is to remind this company, well, you should care about this because the three-year-olds, they're your future employees, they're your future customers, and their parents right now are your current employees and customers, and they care about this. So they'll want you as their insurance company to care about it too. And I think I can understand on like a personal moral level why it might seem gross to people to talk about it in that way. I don't actually disagree with the anonymous person on that. But I also think that more than anything, more than a liberal or a conservative or anything like that, I'm a pragmatist. And that's how I align politically. And I think it's unavoidable that if you are talking to a company and you want them to support something, you have to tell them why it matters to them. And this is the language that you have to use. The only thing I'd say is maybe it's a slightly different for me because I'm doing this as an application to a company privately that no one outside of my team ever sees, whereas she's doing it as like a PR exercise with articles and speeches and things on social media. And so it's very easy for people who are not part of the charity world or are not part of the corporate world to look at it and not like the language. Yeah, I think that's maybe why some people are having an issue with it, when actually this every single charity you support will talk to companies like this.
Yeah, I was I met up with a friend of mine the other day, and she goes to a group for parents of disabled children, and it's all about kind of you know, when you have children, you have these expectations for them. And obviously when you find out, you know, they're disabled or you get a diagnosis of some kind, you have to reevaluate these expectations. And she was saying that like the woman who runs the group talks a lot about how we view children in a very capitalist way. We think about them as future workers or future parents and future providers. And often when you have a child born with a life-limiting condition, they can't do that because they're not going to make adulthood. So there's a real struggle because everything around children is very heavily geared towards when you grow up, you're going to be a postman and, you know, help and do all these things. And you said it's a real case of having to like train yourself out of like people don't have to provide a service to live. Like children are just children, and sometimes that's all you're ever going to be is, you know, a child, but that child deserves the same kind of rights and happiness and protection as someone running a business and providing jobs to 100 people. And I think, you know, it's something like, it's almost like it's common sense, but you don't think about it. And I think the rhetoric Kate uses veers very much in towards that capitalist camp. And I think there are, you know, like I said, I think it's quite obvious reason for it most of the time. But I also can see why, particularly for younger people, for people who maybe don't have children yet or anything like that, or can find it very abrasive, because you're like, hang on. Why should children have to be workers when they grow up?
Exactly. Yeah, I think it's the context. Like this, if this was a conversation between Kate and businesses, this would be entirely appropriate. But because it's kind of gone outside of that world and has been viewed by people who are maybe not running a company or have not been part of a charity or just think about things through a very specific lens, then I can understand why it would be controversial to people. And this is something I wrestle with as well. Like, I know this is not a therapy podcast, but I really,
while we're here,
I do enjoy my job, but you know, we talk quite a lot as a team about the fact that, you know, I make a lot of my money. I make a lot of the income for the charity through talking to billionaires. And I don't believe that billionaires should exist. I don't believe anybody should be allowed to amass that level of wealth. And I also don't believe that anybody who is a billionaire has amassed that through ethical means. I don't think it's possible to be a billionaire and be ethical. It just doesn't happen. But I still have to get money from them. And, you know, ultimately, I think a lot of charitable giving is to avoid paying tax and to have control over, I think we talked about this in a previous episode, to kind of have control over your income and where it goes. So you choose to donate to charities rather than giving it as tax. And I think that's morally objectionable. But at the end of the day, I could just sit back and be like, oh, well, you know, I don't agree with this morally, so I don't think charity should have any money or should exist. But on a pragmatic level, people need help now. And in order to get that, I have to work with rich people, and I have to convince companies that they should care about this because of future, you know, services that they might get from the children that we support. So is it uncomfortable? Absolutely. But I think maybe this is a function of getting older. But now I'm 30 years old. It's kind of like, I'm much less idealistic. And I realize you have to do stuff like this because that's the world that we live in. And until we dismantle capitalism, it will be the world that we live in. And we just kind of have to deal with it. So I actually think, like, it's not a problem that she talks about it in this way with companies. I think that's unavoidable. I think it's not a problem in terms of the companies that she's chosen to work with. I guess really the question is, did she have to do this at all?
Yeah, it was a really weird one because it felt very much out of the left field.
Yes.
She is. And I kind of have sort of two strands of opinion. And one of them is, no, she didn't.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you can do this, you can promote early, crushes in places of employment without having to work with the business, you know, without having to have a business task force. It wasn't necessary in the same way that perhaps the earlier steering group initially was necessary. Mm-hmm. It kind of feels like, I understand it, but it does feel a bit like, oh, we need to do something else. Mm-hmm. Just do a business task force. That'll cover it.
Yeah.
And then the other strand was kind of, like, maybe it wasn't necessary, but it's by no means the first royal project to do this. And it's quite a well-known and well-tested approach to promoting social rights is to work via business. So it balances out, really.
Yeah, I feel this way about most of Kate's things, where it's like, part of me likes it, part of me doesn't. A lot of what she's talked about in some of the statements and things is about the fact that if you're a company, you know, some of the companies on this list employ over 60,000 people. They're massive, some of the biggest employers in the UK. And a lot of their workforce are going to be parents of young children, or grandparents of young children, even perhaps. And so it's a very valuable market to tap into, because if you're a parent, you want to be able to pick your child up from school and drop them off from school, but that might not work for you working a 9-to-5 job. Or you might have to work from home one day because your child is sick, and you need to know that your workplace is going to support you in doing that. And so I think that trying to shift the mindset of workplaces so that they can provide the support to parents is a really, really valuable thing, because, you know, she's right that the well-being of the parent is the biggest indicator of the well-being of the child. It's kind of like that analogy of putting your oxygen mask on first on an airplane. You can't pour from an empty cup. I'm throwing a lot of analogies in here. but that's the idea. So I actually think that the concept of working with businesses is a very smart one, because they're a very valuable market. I guess I'm a bit confused around kind of the timing of it, because she launched her main steering group ages ago, and then she launched like another steering group, and then she launched this animation. And I kind of feel like, I think with Earthshot, they announced a lot of stuff altogether. I felt like it was like they'd been working away privately in the background, and then bam, they came out with this really fully realized idea. Whereas the earlier, it kind of feels like, oh, maybe we should work with businesses. Let's add these in 3 months after we've launched the main steering group. So I feel like it could have come at the time of the launch, that like, we're going to have this main steering group, and then we're going to have the business steering group underneath it, or much later on, like once the group has actually achieved something.
Yeah, it also felt like notable weird timing, because it happened on that day, on the Tuesday, and there was no, and then the Financial Times article and the weird video of her in an Iceland store in the middle
first
of
time she's ever been to an Iceland, I think.
Yeah, like just awkwardly stood in the middle of the aisles, came out on the Saturday, but there was no like follow through beyond that. And I think something the Shaping Us campaign launch did really well was, despite being one engagement, it was an entire week of appearances and videos, and it felt like, you know what, this was the Shaping Us week, and it ended with, you know, a little video, and it all worked quite cohesively together. Whereas this was like, oh, we're announcing a business task force, which is irrelevant to most of the population because we're not businessmen, and I wasn't in that room. And then she's written an article that her name was on, but it wasn't like heavily publicized that this was the special think piece. And then there was like a tiny video that wasn't, you know, like it could have aired on TV as an Iceland advert. I don't know. Like there were ways to make it more, I don't say palatable, but more relatable to the person who, you know, at the end result is the one being impacted, which, you know, parents and young people, which it currently was not doing.
Yeah, definitely. I think like, yeah, even just having another video that was in there that was actually talking to staff members might have been nice. And I guess, like, I mean, I haven't read the Financial Times article, so maybe it says it in there, but I think she's really good at expressing, she obviously knows a lot about this subject. I've never disputed that Kate knows a lot about the early years and has learned a lot over the years, but I think she's very good at expressing like why companies should care about this issue. But I still am not 100% sure what she wants them to do. And I know that it's early days, and normally if you launch something like this, you might then take a while to announce the next steps. But this is a project where she had like, I mean, she announced it originally when she was pregnant with Louis. And how old is he now?
Nearly five.
So she had like 3 years or something, 4 years before she launched anything, really, where they were just meeting constantly, but nothing ever came out. And so I just feel like if it had been something that she'd launched and we'd never heard of it before, then I would have understood that it would take months or years even potentially to get some solid actions. But because they've had such a long time to build this all up, I would have thought that she would have come out of the gate with like, even just something like, we'd like companies to sign up to this charter, a commitment, and we get different organizations to sign up to this commitment, and it has certain actions in it that you should take. I don't know, it just, like a lot of things with this early years initiative, I don't disagree with the idea. I don't disagree with the concept or her getting involved in it. I think it could be really valuable, but it feels messy. Like even with the Shaping Us thing, I still don't know what I, as a 30-year-old who, except from your nephew, has not had any contact with any child under the age of 5 in years, what do I do? And I think that's the same thing with like companies. I know it's not necessarily directed at me, but if I was running a company, I'd be like, okay, great, I fully support you on this idea, but what am I supposed to do?
Yeah, she said a lot of like really overarching things like we need to prioritize and cultivate experience of positive mental well-being for young people. I'm like, what does that mean though? Like, how do I physically do that? Stop saying buzzwords at me and just tell me what to do. And sometimes it feels almost like she's trying really hard not to overstep. But if you're leading from the front in this way, you need to overstep, you need to be really explicit. And I think that's what Earthshot did so well with saying like, they were very grandiose with their statements, but they came out going, this is what we're going to do with a Nobel Prize of the Earth, and we're the best thing that's ever happened, and we're going to change the world. And it was really grandiose, but you knew what they were about straight from the beginning. And, you know, as it's grown, because, you know, Earthshot's got the Global Alliance or whatever it is, which is a bunch of companies that work with it and, you know, provide money. And I've not heard anyone call William a capitalism Barbie recently.
No.
Point is, Capitalism Barbie and Ken. But I think if you've got something that, you know, if you're going to make this your thing and you are going to, you know, Kate is very knowledgeable in this area. She does lead from the front, but she needs to tell people what to do because at the moment, it's a leader who is like, and let's all discuss together. And I'm like, no, just tell me. Tell me what I need to do and I'll do it. I don't have time to discuss it. I've got some life.
Yeah, I think like you don't have to come out with absolutely everything that's going to be in your campaign right from the very beginning. Like obviously campaigns will develop and grow and things will change over time, but I feel like come out with something. Just having like one action to take would have been really beneficial. I don't know why the Earthshot people at the Royal Foundation are so good and the early years people are just not great.
Yeah, like they need to swap teams just for a week and see what happens.
Yeah.
It was a really weird, I think overall, like looking at the business task force, it was really weird because like a lot of the initial public comments were wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And then a lot of the commentary kind of started to really lean into misogyny. Like, why is this woman talking to these businesses like,
yes.
when the male royals spend half their life working with businesses? But then, like, the essence of it, like, the actual core idea almost feels a little bit flawed. And it feels like everything she does with Earlier just needs, like, one extra week of focus.
Yes.
It's like someone's got given her a project. And she's like, oh, yeah, I'll get that done. And then the week before, she's like, oh, yes, I did remember about that. I have got my notes here. And she just reads the notes rather than the finished product.
Yeah, it's definitely not the idea. It's the delivery of it that I think is an issue. And that has been consistent with the Earlier thing of, like, you could not find somebody who supports the idea of something around the early years more than me. Like, huge fan. I just don't think that it has been very well managed so far. Okay, so thank you for joining us for this episode this week. Now, we are off next week, aren't we, Grace?
Yes, sorry, I booked things and forgot about Sundays were podcast day.
That's absolutely fine. I am looking forward to having a bit of a break. Yeah, we will be taking a week off, so hopefully nobody does anything dramatic. Everybody keep your fingers crossed for no deaths, marriages, or babies. But other than that, we will see you the week after. And why not take the opportunity to go and listen back to all the episodes you've missed during our week off? But other than that, it is a goodbye from me.
And goodbye from me.